Do you know where that sign comes from? It stands for the initials of the United States. He snapped the flashlight off, but he did not move to go. She could distinguish the hint of his bitter smile. Do you know that the United States is the only country in history that has ever used its own monogram as a symbol of depravity? Ask yourself why. Ask yourself how long a country that did that could hope to exist, and whose moral standards have destroyed it. It was the only country in history where wealth was not acquired by looting, but by production. Not by force, but by trade. The only country whose money was the symbol of man's right to his own mind, to his work, to his life, to his happiness, to himself. If this is evil, by the present standards of the world, if this is the reason for damning us, then we, the dollar chasers and makers, accept it, and choose to be damned by that world. We choose to wear the sign of the dollar on our foreheads proudly, as our badge of nobility, the badge we are willing to live for and, if need be, to die. He extended his hand for the package. She held it as if her fingers would not let it go, but gave up and placed it on his palm. With deliberate slowness, as if to underscore the meaning of his gesture, he offered her a cigarette. She took it and placed it between her lips. He took one for himself, struck a match, lighted both, and they walked on. They walked over rotting logs that sank without resistance into the shifting ground, through a vast, uncongealed globe of moonlight and coiling mist. With two spots of living fire in their hands, and the glow of two small circles to light their faces. Fire, a dangerous force, tamed at his fingertips, she remembered the old man saying to her, the old man who had said that these cigarettes were not made anywhere on earth. When a man thinks, there is a spot of fire alive in his mind, and it's proper that he should have the burning point of a cigarette as his one expression. I wish you'd tell me who makes them, she said, in the tone of a hopeless plea. He chuckled good-naturedly. I can tell you this much. They're made by a friend of mine, for sale, but not being a common carrier, he sells them only to his friends. Sell me that package, will you? I don't think you'll be able to afford it, Miss Taggart, but... All right, if you wish. How much is it? 5 cents. 5 cents? She repeated, bewildered. 5 cents, he said, and added, in gold. She stopped, staring at him. In gold? Yes, Miss Taggart. Well, what's your rate of exchange? How much is it in our normal money? There is no rate of exchange, Miss Taggart. No amount of physical or spiritual currency, whose sole standard of value is the decree of Mr. Wesley Mooch, will buy these cigarettes. I see. He reached into his pocket, took out the package, and handed it to her. I'll give them to you, Miss Taggart, he said, because you've earned them, many times over, and because you need them for the same purpose we do. What purpose? To remind us, in moments of discouragement, in the loneliness of exile, of our true homeland, which has always been yours too, Miss Taggart. Thank you, she said. She put the cigarettes in her pocket. He saw that her hand was trembling. When they reached the fourth of the 5 mileposts, they had been silent for a long time, with no strength left for anything but the effort of moving their feet. Far ahead they saw a dot of light, too low on the horizon and too harshly clear to be a star. They kept watching it as they walked, and said nothing until they became certain that it was a powerful electric beacon, blazing in the midst of the empty prairie. "What is that?" she asked. "I don't know," he said. "It looks like..." No, she broke in hastily. It couldn't be. Not around here. She did not want to hear him name the hope which she had felt for many minutes past. She could not permit herself to think of it or to know that the thought was hope. They found the telephone box at the 5th milepost. The beacon hung like a violent spot of cold fire, less than 1/2 mile farther south. The telephone was working. She heard the buzz of the wire like the breath of a living creature when she lifted the receiver. Then a drawling voice answered, "Jessup at Bradshaw." The voice sounded sleepy. "This is Dagny Taggart speaking from..." "Who?" Dagny Taggart, of Taggart Transcontinental, speaking.
Oh. Oh, yes, I see.
Yes? Speaking from your track phone number 83. The Comet is stalled 7 miles north of here. It's been abandoned. The crew is deserted. There was a pause.
Well, what do you want me to do about it?
She had to pause in turn in order to believe it. Are you the night dispatcher?
Yeah.
Then send another crew out to us at once.
A full passenger train crew?
Of course.
Now?
Yes. There was a pause.
The rules don't say anything about that.
Get me the chief dispatcher, she said, choking.
He's away on his vacation.
Get the division superintendent.
He's gone down to Laurel for a couple of days.
Get me somebody who's in charge.
I'm in charge.
Listen, she said slowly, fighting for patience. Do you understand that there's a train? A passenger limited. Abandoned in the middle of the prairie?
Yeah. But how am I to know what I'm supposed to do about it? The rules don't provide for it. Now, if you had an accident, we'd send out the wrecker. But if there was no accident... You don't need the wrecker, do you?
No, we don't need the wrecker. We need men. Do you understand? Living men to run an engine.
The rules don't say anything about a train without men, or about men without a train. There's no rule for calling out a full crew in the middle of the night and sending them to hunt for a train somewhere. I've never heard of it before.
You're hearing it now. Don't you know what you have to do?
Who am I to know?
Do you know that your job is to keep trains moving?
My job is to obey the rules. If I send out a crew when I'm not supposed to, God only knows what's going to happen. What with the Unification Board and all the regulations they've got nowadays, who am I to take it upon myself?
And what's going to happen if you leave a train stalled on the line?
That's not my fault. I had nothing to do with it. They can't blame me. I couldn't help it.
You're to help it now.
Nobody told me to.
I'm telling you to.
How do I know whether you're supposed to tell me or not? We're not supposed to furnish any Taggart crews. You people were to run with your own crews. That's what we were told.
But this is an emergency.
Nobody told me anything about an emergency.
She had to take a few seconds to control herself. She saw Kellogg watching her with a bitter smile of amusement. Listen, she said into the phone. Do you know that the Comet was due at Bradshaw over 3 hours ago?
Oh, sure. But nobody's going to make any trouble about that. No train's ever on schedule these days.
Then do you intend to leave us blocking your track forever?
We've got nothing due till number 4, the northbound passenger out of Laurel, at 8:37 a.m. You can wait till then. The day trick dispatcher will be on then. You can speak to him.
You blasted idiot! This is the Comet!
What's that to me? This isn't Taggart Transcontinental. You people expect a lot for your money. You've been nothing but a headache to us, with all the extra work and no extra pay for the little fellows.
His voice was slipping into whining insolence.
You can't talk to me that way. The time's passed when you could talk to people that way.
She had never believed that there were men with whom a certain method, which she had never used, would work. Such men were not hired by Taggart Transcontinental, and she had never been forced to deal with them before. Do you know who I am? She asked, in the cold, overbearing tone of a personal threat. It worked.
I guess so, he answered.
Then let me tell you that if you don't send a crew to me at once, you'll be out of a job within 1 hour after I reach Bradshaw, which I'll reach sooner or later. You'd better make it sooner.
Yes, ma'am, he said.
Call out a full passenger train crew and give them orders to run us to Laurel, where we have our own men.
Yes, ma'am,
he added.
Will you tell headquarters that it was you who told me to do it?
I will.
And that it's you who's responsible for it?
I am. There was a pause. Then he asked helplessly,
Now, how am I going to call the men? Most of them haven't got any phones.
Do you have a call boy?
Yes, but he won't get here till morning.
Is there anybody in the yards right now?
There's the wiper in the roundhouse.
Send him out to call the men.
Yes, ma'am. Hold the line.
She leaned against the side of the phone box to wait. Kellogg was smiling. And you propose to run a railroad? A transcontinental railroad? With that? He asked. She shrugged. She could not keep her eyes off the beacon. It seemed so close, so easily within her reach. She felt as if the unconfessed thought were struggling furiously against her, splattering bits of the struggle all over her mind. A man able to harness an untapped source of energy. A man working on a motor to make all other motors useless. She could be talking to him, to his kind of brain, in a few hours. In just a few hours. What if there was no need to hurry to him? It was what she wanted to do. It was all she wanted. Her work? What was her work? To move on to the fullest, most exacting use of her mind. Or to spend the rest of her life doing his thinking for a man unfit to be a night dispatcher. Why had she chosen to work? Was it in order to remain where she had started? Night operator of Rockdale Station? No, lower than that. She had been better than that dispatcher even at Rockdale. Was this to be the final sum, an end, lower than her beginning? There was no reason to hurry. She was the reason. They needed the trains, but they did not need the motor. She needed the motor. Her duty? To whom? The dispatcher was gone for a long time. When he came back, his voice sounded sulky.
Well, the wiper says he can get the men all right, but it's no use, because how am I going to send them out to you? We have no engine.
No engine?
No. The superintendent took one to run down to Laurel, and the other's in the shop's been there for weeks, and the switch engine jumped rail this morning. They'll be working on her till tomorrow afternoon.
What about the wrecker's engine that you were offering to send us?
Oh, she's up north. They had a wreck there yesterday. She hasn't come back yet.
Have you a diesel car?
Never had any such thing, not around here.
Have you a track motor car?
Yes, we have that.
Send them out on the track motor car.
Oh. Yes, ma'am.
Tell your men to stop here at track phone number 83 to pick up Mr. Kellogg and myself. She was looking at the beacon.
Yes, ma'am.
Call the Taggart trainmaster at Laurel. Report the Comet's delay and explain to him what happened. She put her hand into her pocket and suddenly clutched her fingers. She felt the package of cigarettes. Say, she asked, what's that beacon about half a mile from here?
From where you are? Oh, that must be the emergency landing field of the flagship airlines.
I see. Well, that's all. Get your men started at once. Tell them to pick up Mr. Kellogg by track phone number 83.
Yes, ma'am.
She hung up. Kellogg was grinning.
An airfield, isn't it? He asked.
Yes. She stood looking at the beacon, her hand still clutching the cigarettes in her pocket.
So they're going to pick up Mr. Kellogg, are they?
She whirled to him, realizing what decision her mind had been reaching without her conscious knowledge. No, she said. No, I didn't mean to abandon you here. It's only that I, too, have a crucial purpose out west where I ought to hurry. So I was thinking of trying to catch a plane. But I can't do it, and it's not necessary.
Come on, he said, starting in the direction of the airfield.
But I...
If there's anything you want to do more urgently than to nurse those morons, go right ahead.
More urgently than anything in the world, she whispered.
I'll undertake to remain in charge for you and to deliver the Comet to your man at Laurel.
Thank you. But if you're hoping... I'm not deserting, you know.
I know.
Then why are you so eager to help me?
I just want you to see what it's like to do something you want for once.
There's not much chance that they'll have a plane at that field.
There's a good chance that they will.
There were two planes on the edge of the airfield. One, the half-charred remnant of a wreck, not worth salvaging for scrap. The other, a Dwight Sanders monoplane, brand new, the kind of ship that men were pleading for in vain all over the country. There was one sleepy attendant at the airfield, young, pudgy, and but for a faint smell of college about his vocabulary, a brain brother of the night dispatcher of Bradshaw. He knew nothing about the two planes. They had been there when he first took this job a year ago. He had never inquired about them, and neither had anybody else. In whatever silent crumbling had gone on at the distant headquarters, in the slow dissolution of a great airline company, the Sanders monoplane had been forgotten, as assets of this nature were being forgotten everywhere, as the model of the motor had been forgotten on a junk pile, and left in plain sight, had conveyed nothing to the inheritors and the takers over. There were no rules to tell the young attendant whether he was expected to keep the Sanders plane or not. The decision was made for him by the brusque, confident manner of the two strangers, by the credentials of Miss Dagny Taggart, vice president of a railroad, by brief hints about a secret emergency mission, which sounded like Washington to him, by the mention of an agreement with the airline's top officials in New York, whose names he had never heard before, by a check for $15,000, written by Miss Taggart as deposit against the return of the Sanders plane, and by another check for $200 for his own personal courtesy. He fueled the plane. He checked it as best he could. He found a map of the country's airports, and she saw that a landing field on the outskirts of Afton, Utah, was marked as still in existence. She had been too tensely, swiftly active to feel anything, but at the last moment, when the attendant switched on the floodlights, when she was about to climb aboard, she paused to glance at the emptiness of the sky, then at Owen Kellogg. He stood alone in the white glare, his feet planted firmly apart, on an island of cement in a ring of blinding lights, with nothing beyond the ring but an irredeemable night. And she wondered which one of them was taking the greater chance and facing the more desolate emptiness. "In case anything happens to me," she said, "will you tell Eddie Willers in my office to give Jeff Allen a job, as I promised?"
"I will." "Is this all you wish to be done in case anything happens?"
She considered it and smiled sadly, in astonishment at the realization. "Yes, I guess that's all. Except tell Hank Reardon what happened, and that I asked you to tell him."
"I will."
She lifted her head and said firmly, "I don't expect it to happen, however. When you reach Laurel, call Winston, Colorado, and tell them that I will be there tomorrow by noon."
"Yes, Miss Taggart."
She wanted to extend her hand in parting, but it seemed inadequate, and then she remembered what he had said about times of loneliness. She took out the package and silently offered him one of his own cigarettes. His smile was a full statement of understanding, and the small flame of his match lighting their two cigarettes was their most enduring handshake. Then she climbed aboard, and the next span of her consciousness was not separate moments and movements, but the sweep of a single motion and a single unit of time, a progression forming one entity, like the notes of a piece of music, from the touch of her hand on the starter to the blast of the motor sound that broke off like a mountain rock slide, all contact with the time behind her, to the circling fall of a blade that vanished in a fragile sparkle of whirling air that cut the space ahead, to the start for the runway, to the brief pause, then to the forward thrust, to the long perilous run, the run not to be obstructed, the straight line run that gathers power by spending it on a harder and harder and ever accelerating effort, the straight line to a purpose, to the moment, unnoticed, when the earth drops off and the line, unbroken, goes on into space in the simple, natural act of rising. She saw the telegraph wires of the trackside slipping past at the tip of her toes. The earth was falling downward, and she felt as if its weight were dropping off her ankles, as if the globe would go shrinking to the size of a ball, a convict's ball she had dragged and lost. Her body swayed, drunk with the shock of a discovery, and her craft rocked with her body, and it was the earth below that reeled with the rocking of her craft, the discovery that her life was now in her own hands, that there was no necessity to argue, to explain, to teach, to plead, to fight, nothing but to see and think and act. Then the earth steadied into a wide sheet that grew wider and wider as she circled, rising. When she glanced down for the last time, the lights of the field were extinguished. There was only the single beacon left, and it looked like the tip of Kellogg's cigarette, glowing as a last salute in the darkness. Then she was left with the lights on her instrument panel and the spread of stars beyond her film of glass. There was nothing to support her but the beat of the engine and the minds of the men who had made the plane. But what else supports one anywhere, she thought. The line of her course went northwest to cut a diagonal across the state of Colorado. She knew she had chosen the most dangerous route, over too long a stretch of the worst mountain barrier. But it was the shortest line, and safety lay in altitude, and no mountains seemed dangerous compared to the dispatcher of Bradshaw. The stars were like foam, and the sky seemed full of flowing motion, the motion of bubbles settling and forming, the floating of circular waves without progression. A spark of light flared up on Earth once in a while, and it seemed brighter than all the static blue above. But it hung alone, between the black of ashes and the blue of a crypt. It seemed to fight for its fragile foothold. It greeted her and went. The pale streak of a river came rising slowly from the void, and for a long stretch of time it remained in sight, gliding imperceptibly to meet her. It looked like a phosphorescent vein showing through the skin of the earth, a delicate vein without blood. When she saw the lights of a town like a handful of gold coins flung upon the prairie, the brightly violent lights fed by an electric current, they seemed as distant as the stars, and now as unattainable. The energy that had lighted them was gone. The power that created power stations in empty prairies had vanished, and she knew of no journey to recapture it. Yet these had been her stars, she thought, looking down. These had been her goal, her beacon, the aspiration drawing her upon her upward course. That which others claimed to feel at the sight of the stars, stars safely distant by millions of years, and thus imposing no obligation to act, but serving as the tinsel of futility. She had felt at the sight of electric bulbs lighting the streets of a town. It was this earth below that had been the height she had wanted to reach. And she wondered how she had come to lose it. Who had made of it a convict's ball to drag through muck? Who had turned its promise of greatness into a vision never to be reached? But the town was past, and she had to look ahead to the mountains of Colorado rising in her way. The small glass dial on her panel showed that she was now climbing. The sound of the engine beating through the metal shell around her, trembling in the wheel against her palms, like the pounding of a heart strained to a solemn effort, told her of the power carrying her above the peaks. The earth was now a crumpled sculpture that swayed from side to side, the shape of an explosion still shooting sudden spurts to reach the plain. She saw them as dented black cuts, ripping through the milky spread of stars, straight in her path and tearing wider. Her mind one with her body, and her body one with the plain, she fought the invisible suction drawing her downward. She fought the sudden gusts that tipped the earth, as if she were about to roll off into the sky, with half of the mountains rolling after. It was like fighting a frozen ocean, where the touch of a single spray would be fatal. There were stretches of rest when the mountains shrank down, over valleys filled with fog. Then the fog rose higher to swallow the earth, and she was left suspended in space, left motionless but for the sound of the engine. But she did not need to see the earth. The instrument panel was now her power of sight. It was the condensed sight of the best minds able to guide her on her way. Their condensed sight, she thought, offered to hers, and requiring only that she be able to read it. How had they been paid for it, they, the sight-givers? From condensed milk to condensed music to the condensed sight of precision instruments, what wealth had they not given to the world, and what had they received in return? Where were they now? Where was Dwight Sanders? Where was the inventor of her motor? The fog was lifting, and in a sudden clearing she saw a drop of fire on a spread of rock. It was not an electric light. It was a lonely flame in the darkness of the earth. She knew where she was, and she knew that flame. It was Wyatt's torch. She was coming close to her goal. Somewhere behind her in the northeast stood the summits pierced by the Taggart Tunnel. The mountains were sliding in a long descent into the steadier soil of Utah. She let her plane slip closer to the earth. The stars were vanishing. The sky was growing darker. But in the bank of clouds to the east, thin cracks were beginning to appear, first as threads, then faint spots of reflection, then straight bands that were not yet pink, but no longer blue, the color of a future light. The first hints of the coming sunrise. They kept appearing and vanishing, slowly growing clearer, leaving the sky darker, then breaking it wider apart like a promise struggling to be fulfilled. She heard a piece of music beating in her mind, one she seldom liked to recall. not Hallie's fifth concerto, but his fourth. The cry of a tortured struggle, with the chords of its theme breaking through like a distant vision to be reached. She saw the Afton airport from across a span of miles, first as a square of sparks, then as a sunburst of white rays. It was lighted for a plane about to take off, and she had to wait for her landing. Circling in the outer darkness above the field, she saw the silver body of a plane rising like a phoenix out of the white fire. And, in a straight line, almost leaving an instant's trail of light to hang in space behind it, going off toward the east. Then she swept down in its stead to dive into the luminous funnel of beams. She saw a strip of cement flying at her face. She felt the jolt of the wheels stopping it in time, then the streak of her motion ebbing out and the plane being tamed to the safety of a car as it taxied smoothly off the runway. It was a small private airfield serving the meager traffic of a few industrial concerns still remaining in Afton. She saw a lone attendant hurrying to meet her. She leaped down to the ground the moment the plane stood still, the hours of the flight swept from her mind by the impatience over the stretch of a few more minutes. "Can I get a car somewhere to drive me to the Institute of Technology at once?" she asked. The attendant looked at her, puzzled. "Why, yes, I guess so, ma'am, but what for? There's nobody there."
"Mr. Quentin Daniels is there."
The attendant shook his head slowly, then jerked his thumb pointing east to the shrinking taillights of the plane. "There's Mr. Daniels going now."
"What?"
"He just left."
"Left why?"
"He went with the man who flew in for him 2-3 hours ago."
"What man?"
"Don't know, never saw him before, but boy, he's got a beauty of a ship." She was back at the wheel. She was speeding down the runway. She was rising into the air, her plane like a bullet aimed at two sparks of red and green light that were twinkling away into the eastern sky, while she was still repeating, "Oh, no, they don't. They don't. They don't. They don't." Once and for all, she thought, clutching the wheel as if it were the enemy not to be relinquished, her words like separate explosions with a trail of fire in her mind to link them. Once and for all, to meet the destroyer face to face, to learn who he is and where he goes to vanish. Not the motor. He is not to carry the motor away into the darkness of his monstrously closed unknown. He is not to escape this time. A band of light was rising in the east, and it seemed to come from the earth, as a breath long held and released. In the deep blue above it, the stranger's plane was a single spark, changing color and flashing from side to side, like the tip of a pendulum swinging in the darkness, beating time. The curve of distance made the spark drop closer to the earth, and she pushed her throttle wide open not to let the spark out of her sight, not to let it touch the horizon and vanish. The light was flowing into the sky, as if drawn from the earth by the stranger's plane. The plane was headed southeast, and she was following it into the coming sunrise. From the transparent green of ice, the sky melted into pale gold, and the gold spread into a lake under a fragile film of pink glass, the color of that forgotten morning which was the first she had seen on earth. The clouds were dropping away in long shreds of smoky blue. She kept her eyes on the stranger's plane as if her glance were a tow line pulling her ship. The stranger's plane was now a small black cross, like a shrinking check mark on the glowing sky. Then she noticed that the clouds were not dropping, that they stood congealed on the edge of the earth. And she realized that the plane was headed toward the mountains of Colorado, that the struggle against the invisible storm lay ahead for her once more. She noted it without emotion. She did not wonder whether her ship or her body had the power to attempt it again. So long as she was able to move, she would move to follow the speck that was fleeing away with the last of her world. She felt nothing but the emptiness left by a fire that had been hatred and anger, and the desperate impulse of a fight to the kill. These had fused into a single icy streak, the single resolve to follow the stranger, whoever he was, wherever he took her, to follow and... She added, nothing in her mind, but unstated what lay at the bottom of the emptiness was, and give her life, if she could take his first.